Hello, and welcome to episode 26 of the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors. My name is Cedaring Fox, Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Pitt, UK founder and creative partner. For nearly two decades, we've been casting great actors to bring beautifully written stories to life with the writers in the room to hear their stories read. To continue to share these performances free on this podcast, we need your support. Please visit wordtheatre.org to learn how to become an annual member and enjoy the perks, including access to all our live performances in theatres and online.
On today's episode, we are very pleased to present Bhaskar Patel performing Roshi Fernando's story, The Fluorescent Jacket. Roshi's story was shortlisted for the 2011 Sunday Times EFG Short Story Award, the richest prize for a single short story in the English language. 2011 was the first year that Kirsty and I cast and directed the shortlisted stories for this prize. We fell in love with both actor and author. Born in London to Sri Lankan parents, here is Roshi Fernando.
Hi, I'm Roshi Fernando. The Fluorescent Jacket became the best story of my collection, Homesick, a collection I'd conceived as a community of people I bumped up against in South London growing up in the 70s and 80s. Kumar is poor and dependent, as a lot of people fresh out of their countries of origin are when they come to the UK. The abuse suffered by the child in the story was not imagined. I wanted to explore pain that had been unseen and to figure out why it had happened. What I didn't realise when I wrote it was how it would affect others. My husband Tom and I went to a reading of the story in Oxford College as part of the Sunday Times EFG Short Story Prize. I had been shortlisted with The Fluorescent Jacket. We sat near the front and watched Bhaskar Patel, a small, unassuming actor, take on the character of Kumar. The audience stilled, and when he read the last page, his voice broke and he teared up. I shifted in my seat and watched as others around me cried. Even Tom cried. It made me uncomfortable at the time, but now I still wonder at that moment. My words did that. An actor took them and made them real. Those tears seemed like balm, healing that long ago pain.
"It seems," he says, "the rain coming every day." He says, "seems." The girls do not stifle their laughter, but burst with a kind mirth in their corner of the kitchen. Their mother turns her face from him, and he knows the stare that silences them, the same grimace her own mother would have given to her. He remembers his aunt's fierceness, her vicious tongue. "They're doing no harm," he says in Sinhala. But his cousin shakes his excuses off. Her ponytail tremor, the only movement in the dark Edwardian kitchen. The rain, the only distant sound. He cannot even hear the girl's breathing. "It seems like it rains every day," Shamini corrects him now. He glances quickly at the girls, and they are waiting for him to repeat the words. They are taller and fatter than girls he is used to in Sri Lanka. The older one has ribbons in her hair, the younger a fringe which covers one eye. The skin of their cheeks is taut, as if it is stretched over gourds. He chooses the smaller one, her one eye, and he repeats to her, "It seems like it rains every day." She smiles encouragingly. She must be 8. Her hand comes up and she pushes the hair from her eyes. She looks at him and he winks at her. Both girls laugh again. The mother makes a swipe at the air in front of them and they stumble up and clear plates and the Pyrex butter dish, the pots of jam and the golden syrup tin. They are like puppies, he thinks, watching their bottoms wobble. They are like weak old dogs. Soon he limps out into the grim London day. He goes to the train station and, following the instructions Shamini has written, he buys a ticket from the machine. He presses the button for New Cross Gate, then waits on the wrong side of the station, boards the wrong train, and goes most of the way to Croydon. He shows his direction to an African on the train. The African shakes his head. There are no other people he can ask, only white fellows. The African points to the door and to the other train. The door is about to close, he jumps off. He gets on to the other train as its doors slide to, and he stands by them, looking out to the train he just left. The African is at the doors. He smiles, shakes his head from side to side. The African turns away as their double doors smoothly glide in opposite directions. He watches the rain on his window. He watches the incessant water beyond the window. The steadiness of the droplets on the glass calms him, and he dares himself to reach forward to follow the root of one of the threads of water. But his hand is scared. His body is frightened of being out alone in the huge, vast world. He sees his reflection when they go into a tunnel and finds it remarkable. It is his face, but his body is in a too large coat, and water is percolating through him as if he were simply not seen, as if he were a filter for rain. At New Cross, he walks back and forth along the streets, following Shamini's map. He cannot find the street she has spelled out. He shuffles. His shoes are too big. He sees more Africans leaning against a car. One of them shouts to him, but he puts his head down and walks more quickly. He looks behind him, sees they are laughing. He is worried he will lose the station and will not find his way back to Shamini's. He steps into a road and a car sounds its horn, but not like in Colombo where everyone uses the horn. The car is like a bull, shouting in anger. He steps back, looks about, and people are watching him, and people are everywhere. He does not find the building, but he finds someone who wants him. A man is beckoning him and asks him if he wants work. He nods. Name?
Kumar, he whispers.
What? Kumar? The man writes it down. Your trousers too long. Roll them up. You're gonna get covered in shit, the man says. He points at Kumar's legs, and when he realizes that he does not understand, he mimes rolling, as if he were winding a clock or wringing a towel. Kumar rolls his trousers up. Yeah. And the man hands Kumar a fluorescent jacket. It is yellowy green, the color of two ripe limes. Around the bottom edge is sewn an orange strip, its color as loud as the yellow. Kumar takes off his coat, the one that belonged to Shamini's ex-husband. He puts on the fluorescent jacket. Get in the van, the man says. Shamini asks, lunches? Made? The girls nod. Go on then, brush your teeth. She calls after them. She turns to Kumar. How long more with these people?
5 days.
They are paying you nothing, man.
He says authoritatively.
He knows she will start to nag or to whine if he does not shut her up. When will they give you the money?
They give him the money at the end of each day, but he has told her it will be at the end of the week. He has already bought a present for the younger girl, Lolly, a plastic doll with blonde hair and enormous breasts. He has bought ribbons for the older girl. He has bought a bottle of whiskey. The rest of the money he has put into a biscuit box in the bottom of his suitcase. At the end of the week, he will give Shamini £20. That is what they have agreed. He clears the breakfast now. He washes up before he goes out. He waits to hear Shamini's car door slam, and then he uses the bathroom. Before he leaves the house, he makes Lolly's bed. He picks up her duvet and shakes it, breathing in her sleepy odors, picking up her pillow and smoothing the sheet below, holding the pillow against his chest. The bulk of it against him, mixed with the headiness of her aura, makes him hard. It is not raining, and he notices that the park on the way to the station gleams in the sunshine the way that paddy fields are luminescent after rain in Sri Lanka. He is wearing his work jacket, and he sees there are others with the same jacket working in the park. He will miss the first train, but he goes in. He wanders toward where the gardeners are digging. An African with long braided hair looks at him and points at the tools leaning against a railing. "You're late," he says. Kumar takes a fork and climbing over the knee-high fencing, he joins the African, watching him to make sure he knows what he's doing. "Take it all out, man," the African says. Kumar begins to dig. He drinks whiskey in the morning after they have left. He drinks, then dons the jacket. He does not eat because he has stopped paying Shamini. He drinks more if it is raining. He slurs when he speaks, he has noticed, so he does not speak. At the park, they point at tools, sometimes give him a cup of tea. But he is not earning money. He has walked into their team employed by the council with structures of paperwork converting their calluses into the notes and coins in his colleagues' pockets, and he does not speak or hear enough to understand this magic trick. He earns a small amount cleaning and restocking the 24-hour shop, but they are Tamils, and they don't like him. They pay him enough to buy a bottle of whiskey and a loaf of bread every day. The blurred pictures he sees in this huge world make him feel inured to it. He is used to it, yes, but he is still afraid. His English has not improved. He does not practice because no one speaks to him at the park or at Shamini's house. And the Tamils speak Tamil to each other. He tried speaking Sinhali once to the boss, and the man looked the other way, frowned. Lolly's sister, Deirdre, is causing trouble. A few days ago, he heard her use the word stinky. He had watched enough American soap operas to know that this word meant his smell. Shamini ignores him, though. She asked for money at the end of the first week and then stopped. He knows she owes his father money, and that is why she continues to have him under her roof. He wonders if she needs a man in the house now her husband has left. He does not question his status in their house any more than he questions the wet air around him. When he arrives home this evening, the door opens to wailing. He hears Deirdre and Lolly crying in their rooms. Shamini looks glass-eyed. "What has happened?" he asks her, and is surprised at his own words, because they are English words, not Sinhala. "Some girls from Lolly's school have disappeared," Shamini says. He takes the news into him the way he takes in water or whiskey or breath. His head tilts this way and then the other, the lines of his mouth pushing down into his chin, his lips pursed in a non-committal acknowledgement. "What to do?" Shamini says. "Children go missing all the time in Sri Lanka," he thinks. "In Sri Lanka, I went missing for a time. No one cried for me." He removes his jacket and takes it out to the porch to shake it into the dark early evening. He looks down the street at the cars driving fast and the traffic lights at the bottom of the hill. Everything is so orderly and smooth, like it is all on the inside. The roads conveyor belts like at the airport, the cars, suitcases, the houses, people, their eyes staring at him, their mouths pursed in disapproval. He closes the door and comes inside.
He goes to the bathroom and washes his upper body under his arms, splashing the water up into his armpits. He looks briefly into the mirror. His eyes are bloodshot and his hair is long. He has grown a mustache and beard that looks like coconut husk. Kumar goes to the room and gets his wash bag. Lolly looks out at him as he goes back to the bathroom. He winks solemnly at her. She looks steadily back. Shamini talks on the telephone after the dinner he has been invited to join. He hears her hushed voice as he washes up, and he knows she's talking to their family in Sri Lanka. The girls have been sent to bed, and now he sits on the edge of his own single bed in the box room in silence. He takes his whiskey bottle from his suitcase under his bed and glugs back the remains. The room is blue, and he feels its coldness. The bed is surrounded by tea chests, which have failed to be carried into the attic. The ladder is at the foot of his bed, but he has not been up there. It is not his business. It does not interest him. He remains on the edge of the bed, waiting for Shamini's voice to stop, for sleep to come, or morning. When he is at the park, digging earth, he feels happy. Earth is earth, whatever its color. In Sri Lanka, the earth is red and dusty, as if the sun has crumbled like cake. But here, the earth feels heavy and is black, wrought from ore. It feels good in his hands. It feels like he holds people in his hands, people from pasts he has no knowledge of. But when he dies, he does not want to be swallowed up by this country, to become part of the heavy blackness. He will go back to Sri Lanka, he thinks, to die. To disappear into dust there, that is his ambition. Lolly comes into the box room. He has dozed off in his clothes, lying sideways on his bed, his feet still in his shoes, still touching the ground. She puts her ear to her shoulder and smiles into his eyes. Ami said she's going to get rid of you. She told someone on the phone. She whispers. He does not move. She hypnotizes a demon in a plump child, the spit on her lips enticing. They stare at one another. Then in a sudden movement, he sits up straight and she flinches back. He pats the bed. Come, sit. She looks at him, pulls her robe around her nightie. Her hair is disheveled, the curly strands sticking up in places. How old you are? 8, she says, and he does not understand why she talks of height. She says it again and then holds up 8 fingers. He says, 8, and Senala. They sit gingerly apart. His fingers judder across the worn candlewick bedspread. He can see her giggle. Her hand comes up to her face. Her eyes are hidden from him, so that when he pinches her arm, he cannot see if she is pleased or scared. He does not want her to be scared. You very pretty. No, I'm not, she says straight back. Deirdre is the pretty one. I'm the clever one, Ammi says. He says. He pinches her arm again. Ow, don't do that. She presses her fingers where he hurt her. He looks at her fingers, so small and sweet, their nails broken and bitten. Come closer. No, come. Will you? She edges toward his part of the bed. He smells her, her creaminess, her warmth. Closer? I will tell secret. What? She asks open-mouthed. He sees the little tongue at the back of her throat. It is an obscene, dangling sign of welcome. He leans toward her. I have present, he says and winks. What? What is it? He holds her gaze, then moves suddenly again, enjoying her shudder. He pulls the suitcase from below the bed. His body bends and stretches the way it does when he digs plants into the earth. He takes the plastic doll from the suitcase and places it in her lap.
Oh, she says. Why? You no like?
I've got one. She places it on the bed between them. He pushes the case back under the bed with his feet. I have to go back to bed. Ammi will be cross. When she gets up to go, he reaches and holds her hand, tugging her back. She looks scared, and he enjoys her fear, smiling into her face, squeezing her hand until it hurts her, until it hurts his own fingers. She says nothing, but looks into him and understands. He remembers feeling how she feels. He lets go of her hand. Go to bed. She opens his door, and putting her head down, she darts back to her room. He can hear the television, laughter, carrying up the stairs from the living room, and it makes him feel even colder. He draws the bedspread up and around his shoulders and lies back down on the bed. The next day in the park, he is sent with a young white fellow, Cal, to the brambles behind the toilets. They tell them to clear it all. When the supervisor walks away, Cal sits on the ground, his back against the wall, and takes out cigarettes. He offers one to Kumar. Kumar takes one, surprised at this kindness. This is fucked, the boy says. He nods toward the scrubland where ash saplings and brambles are their painful day ahead. Kumar shakes his head loosely in an indifferent agreement. He smokes the cigarette down to the filter, throwing it into the bushes. He walks to the edge, sees the width of the sharp-thorned creepers, and looks back at Cal, still seated. I'll watch you, mate, he laughs. Kumar brings the wheelbarrow around and finds gloves and long-handled cutters. He begins to hack into the wilderness, pulling at the weeds with his left hand, grasping loosely so that the thorns do not pierce him through the gloves. He looks back at the white fellow and realizes that he will not help. His head is back against the wall, his eyes shut. He wears a fluorescent jacket, but it seems for nothing. He wears it for no reason. Kumar works swiftly, cutting down woody limbs to the left, to the right, straight ahead, until he has a sizable patch cleared. He stops, fetches the wheelbarrow, and fills it with the remains he has cut. He pushes this to Cal, and pressing the wheels against his foot, indicates with his head where it should be taken. The young man sucks his teeth, but stands and picks up the wheelbarrow and wheels it off. Kumar takes a fork and starts to dig at the roots of the plants he has just cut down. It is heavy, hard work, but the sun is beginning to warm through the clouds, and he becomes sweaty and happy. He removes his fluorescent jacket, takes off his jumper, and puts the jacket on again. To the left of the toilets, there is a different patch, which seems to have been better cared for. The brambles have been cut back, and there is a sort of tunnel through the saplings, a pathway perhaps made by wild animals. When the man comes back, he points to the other long-handled cutters and says, "You, this one." "Nah, mate, you fucking do it. I'm fucking ill." He sits back down. Kumar is not angry. It is not his business. He continues with his work, cutting back, cutting down. He wishes he had a sickle or a machete or a mammete, the beautifully shaped spade folding sideways that cuts and digs the earth as if it were food on a plate. He feels the sun hotter on the back of his neck, and the sound of the breeze closes his eyes so that he is home in the hills, and if he opens his eyes, he will see the startling green of a paddy field.
Hey! Oh my fucking Christ!
Cal shouts. And when Kumar opens his eyes, he sees his jacket first, and it is a paddy field swimming up. But beyond the paddy field is a child's face in the black dirt. He stands quiet still. The white man is screaming. Below Kumar's feet, a curly-haired child stares at him, lying in that tunnel of scrub, dead. He steps back. The white man has run away, shouting. He looks at the girl. She is brown, her hair black. She is a pretty girl. He stands and stares at her. He looks at her hands. Her fingers are long. She has no clothes. He looks away from her body, looks beyond her, and he sees another face, another pair of eyes. That little face is white, and the eyes are blue. There is a white child lying in the earth. This is what scares Kumar, the blue eyes. He steps back, steps away. He walks backward, still staring. And when the African with the long hair reaches him, he's shaking. "Oh, man," the African says. Kumar turns and walks away. No one notices him go. They are all crying because they found the little lost girls. As he walks out of the park, he hears the police sirens, so many, coming in every direction. He stops and watches them descend on the park, halting their cars at angles to the front gate so that cars driving past have to give way to each other. Leaving their doors open and their blue lights circling in the air, the policemen race in like toy men, their arms and legs making clockwork motions. The two men open the main gate wide, and a police van and an ambulance drive in. He turns away and walks up the hill. He's arrested 4 months later. It takes 4 months because there are no records for him. No one could understand why he would work for free, and then the penny drops. They swoop on Shamini's house in the middle of the night. It is 2 or 3 weeks after he has started touching Lolly. When the police interview him, they ask Shamini to be there to translate. She refuses. She hates him. They call in a Sinhala speaker, a lay preacher from the local community. A member of the church, one of the detectives, attends. He whispers the Sinhala words to Kumar as if ashamed of the language, and then speaks the English reply loudly, clearly, as if the interviewer is deaf. Kumar thinks his arrest is because of the wrong he knows he has done to Lolly. When he's asked about the lost girls, he says readily that he found them. He says he walked away because he was scared. When he's asked why he worked in the park for no money, he replies that he liked working with earth. The translator says, "He's a farmer in Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka, he planted rice." This becomes part of his lore, the story the headline writers use. And in prison, they call him Farmer Boy and Pedo Paddy, and he learns this is a funny joke because only the Irish are called Paddy. They also call him Nuns, and they beat him. Once, he is left for dead. No one fights for him because he never claims his innocence. His English improves and he learns to read books. He takes courses so he may reduce his sentence and be put in a better place in prison. He learns the rules. He learns who to trust and who to work for. He buys cigarettes and a chocolate and puts on some weight. He showers daily and shaves. In prison, he becomes somebody. But he does not forget the moments in the cold box room with Lolly. He lies awake at night and thinks of them. And when he thinks of them, Lolly has blue eyes. He is more scared of this power she and the lost girls have over him than he is of the world outside his door. Prison, in its churning routines, its boredoms, and unpredictable violence becomes safety. In here, even the rain is safe. Even the rain. In Sri Lanka, the rain falls hard, Kumar tells his English tutor. "Write a paragraph about rain," the man, Jim, says. Kumar writes about rain filling streets up like taps filling bowls. He writes about rain that batters coconut matting roofs until the roofs tumble and people inside the huts look up into the deep sky as if they could dive into the sky and swim. "This is good," Jim says. "Now, write about when you were a child. Try and write about how things felt. Kumar, how it felt to be in a monsoon, what you heard, how your skin felt." He thinks about how his skin felt. The fingers of water piercing him through, the rattle on the corrugated roofing of the shack. "I cannot write about that," he says. "But why?" Jim asks. And Kumar nods his head to and fro like a nodding dog in the back of a car, Jim thinks. They smile at each other. Kumar remembers the day he was carried away through the flooding streets, and a schoolboy, clutching his shoes, looked at him as he floated past and suddenly lunged at him, dragged him into his arms, pulled him up onto a wall, and then into a temple flower tree. They sat like monkeys, watching the water flow away. Kumar remembers the boy woke him and carried him down, carried him in his arms until he found people who knew Kumar's parents. He remembers the boy's face straining. He remembers his white uniform, murky and wet. He remembers his mother's cry and his father wresting him out of the schoolboy's arms, and how his mother knelt at the boy's bare feet, touching them with her forehead. Jim says, "You nearly drowned in a monsoon? Can that really happen?" Kumar nods up and down. He has learned to nod yes properly. It is 15 years until they find the man who really killed the girls when he does it again. The DNA is matched, and as easy as a flip of a coin, Kumar is released through a sliding, rackety gate into the fast-moving world he cannot comprehend. He has rejected the clothes he came into prison with. They remind him of Shamini and Lolly. Lolly frightens him. She will be 23 now. And he worries that he may figure in her nightmares as she figures in his. He wears other people's hand-me-downs, the clothes of people who never left the prison. And he wears his fluorescent jacket, for that he thinks truly belongs to him. He goes to the lodgings he has been directed to, using the change they have given him for the bus fare. When he has worked on the roads for a few months, his social worker asks him if he would like to meet some Sri Lankans. He's asked to dinner by the local preacher who translated for him, and that way gets a job in a garage and then on the trains, up and down to Hastings, seeing the sea every day, and he is happy. One day, Shamini is on the train. He nods to her, and she turns her back to him. He is glad not to speak to her, but it is he who paid for her life in England, he wants to say. "When I was 12, they sold me to a German man for the summer." She turns back as if she has heard his thoughts, fumbles in her bag, bringing out her purse. "No. No, appa," he says. "No thanks, in Sinhala." The first Sinhala he has spoken in years. But she takes his hand and palms £20 into it. And then she's gone. He looks at the closing door into the wet October evening. He only sees his eyes reflected back at him. He can actually see himself clearly.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Bhaskar Patel reading Roshi Fernando's The Fluorescent Jacket. If you've been enjoying our free podcast, please write us a review on your favorite podcast platform, tell your friends about us, and invest in a Word Theatre annual membership so you can enjoy all of our live-streamed performances absolutely free.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you to our composer, Jonathan Sachs, and our technical director, Joseph Cho. This is Kirsty Pearce in England.
And I'm Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles. Until next week, signing off.